Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Sandra Shackle about her new book, Working the Land, The Stories of Ranch and Farm Women in the Modern American West, and we will be talking to Loie Fecteau about the Governor's Arts Awards. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program photographer Jack Parsons. His new book is called Dark Beauty, Photographs of New Mexico. And this Sunday at the New Mexico History Museum in Santa Fe, he will be doing a book launch and panel discussion from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
So this is a book of extraordinary, beautiful, interesting photographs of New Mexico. And there's a lot of books of photographs of New Mexico. And this one is particularly striking. And I think the term that you use for the title, Dark Beauty, has a lot to say about it, because there is a kind of darkness that serves as both a visual reference and a metaphor.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, these are photographs that have been culled starting in about 1970 to about 2009, from a lot of work that I've been doing here over many, many years. And these are sort of specific photographs that over this time I kept coming back to, and it really spoke to me, that remained meaningful after all this time. And they're a little darker than what you usually see in the more Chamber of Commerce type of work. And so I was really interested to compile these, because this is the way New Mexico really seems to me once you get beyond the sort of glitter of Santa Fe. And it's a difficult place living here, and it's poor. People have to work very hard to sort of sustain a life here, and that was sort of what I was trying to express with these photographs, was to get beyond the picturesque, even though a lot of these photographs may appear picturesque.
Right. Well, the sense I was getting as I was looking through it was, it just made me think about the difference between a photographer who is fresh to a new place and it's almost like a foreign land for them, and someone who's been here for a long time and has gotten under the layers of it. I mean, as a photographer, you're still taking pictures of surfaces, and yet, to me, these pictures speak of somebody who knows this land better than a newcomer.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that if you live in a place long enough, you eventually sort of strip away the surface, and you find out what those subjects are, what those particular landscapes are, what those situations are that have genuine meaning for you, not just sort of a superficial kind of initial buzz that they may give you. And if you've lived here as long as I have, I came here in like 1969 to Taos, eventually, you know, you do arrive at this kind of work if you're serious about it. So that's why I wanted to do this book, essentially, is because I've done the other stuff. I mean, I made a living doing a lot of it, and
the more sort of stylish.
Yeah, the more I did a lot of sort of style books and interiors and such, which I enjoyed doing, but they were not meaningful. That work isn't meaningful in the same way as something like this. And if you make a place your home, you really want to both share that, but also understand it. And photography's always been my sort of window into this world. And so it's both sort of self-examination, and it's really understanding the place you're going to call home.
There is a kind of light that appears in a lot of the photographs, which is a light that I love. It's kind of when there's a great deal of cloud cover, but the sun gets low in the sky, and then it shines through and illuminates trees or walls or whatever the subject is against a background of great darkness.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's sort of like magic hour stuff, but it goes beyond that, because the subject of the book is dark beauty, and that light is a kind of, as you said earlier, a metaphor for the land here. I mean, it's dark, but it's beautiful, and there's so much stuff going on that you can see that, you know, that just how beautiful this place is, but you also understand just how hard it is, and it is a tough place, New Mexico, and we're not just talking Santa Fe here, we're talking the entire state. As I said in my little piece at the beginning, you know, once you get beyond sort of the glitter of Santa Fe, it's a whole other world out there, and that's really the world that I've always been more interested in.
Well, you can see kind of the rise and fall of fortune, so to speak, of a place. I mean, there are towns that grew up and then died, and the shells of those towns are part of the subject of your book.
Yeah, that's a good comment, because I wasn't really aware of that when I was putting this book together. I was sort of compiling images that were meaningful to me, and then when I started talking with Fred Turner, who was kind enough to do the introduction, his introduction is really about how these photographs exemplify or show sort of memory and loss. And that's a lot of what this book is about. It's about seeing things that sort of trigger these memories and other times. And a lot of it is about times that have passed and events that have passed. And then you see these houses that are sort of going back into the earth, and you just get to feel that this is sort of time immemorial. It just, things keep changing, but at a very slow pace, because this is not California. This is a traditional world here, and so things slow down and everything sort of decays more slowly. But I'm very interested in that whole thing of memory and loss.
The sense one gets, or the sense that I got while looking at these photographs, is the kind of, I mean, even though human beings seem to be doing their very best to destroy the natural environment as quickly as they can, there's this sense of the hugeness of the natural environment and how we're all returning to it. Every person, every plant, every animal, and everything that human beings have built are just here for a moment and then returning. And when I got that sense over and over again looking at your pictures.
Yeah, and you're right. And I think that's one of the things that sort of unconsciously I kept sort of referencing with these photographs, or kept being drawn to certain photographs that I'd taken and that then were compiled in this book, is just how extraordinary and enduring the landscape here is in New Mexico. I mean, it's almost impossible to ignore it. You're always watching the sky or the landscape, and you just see yourself in a different perspective, and buildings and everything, you know, they're just sort of a temporary sort of moment within the landscape. And so I'm very drawn to that kind of landscape that has a sort of a overarching effect on us.
Yeah, well, like the clouds. I mean, you take pictures of clouds. Everybody and their brother takes pictures of clouds. But in this book, I saw clouds that you photographed that reflected to me a certain character that some of these, I don't know what they're called in scientific terms, but very kind of strange, bumpy, patterny clouds that have almost a character of their own.
Yeah, they sort of cumulus and cirrus clouds and such, they have this sort of darkness at their heart, a lot of them, and that's sort of part of the book, because it acts again as a symbol or metaphor for this whole land that we live in, and how difficult it is to live here, and what everybody has had to go through who's been here and who's survived it, essentially. Again, I can't stress strongly enough that once you get beyond the sort of certain superficial aspects of, say, living in Santa Fe, of just how difficult it is to live in New Mexico, how hard people have to work, how...
Did you make friends with people in the places that you photographed?
Oh yeah, always. I mean, I've traveled this state back and forth and back and forth for many, many years, either making films or working on different book projects or working on magazine projects. So I know it pretty well by now, and I did it. I always talk to people wherever I go, and so that was part of the process.
And I imagine that especially in some of the, there's a lot of pictures of crucifixes and religious pictures and also pictures of people's homes and cars and so on. And all of those tell stories that I almost wish I knew what they were when looking at the pictures.
Yeah, I mean, it would take forever to to deconstruct all that stuff. But it's true, and a lot of it is Hispanic, is the Hispanic world for me, because I'm very interested in that, and I have a number of, you know, friends within that world, and so I've always been sort of drawn to it, and I've been drawn to the sort of the huge emphasis and effect of religion within that world, and these things that you need if you're going to survive and endure in a place like this.
Right.
So I am drawn to it, yeah.
How do you see people using religion, using crucifixes and Virgins of Guadalupe and so on?
Well, I just think it's you know, religion and is such an inevitable and intertwined part of say the Hispanic world here. I mean, it their faith is what allowed them to survive so often, and so it's just. That's one of the things I enjoy about the Hispanic culture is that, you know, it survives, and it's not prey to, you know, all these different currents. I mean, it's very strong, and so having that faith, you know, it always becomes exemplified or it becomes apparent through things like crucifixes and through, you know, the Catholic religion essentially, you know, and all those aspects. But I mean, it's all just a metaphor for, you know, this kind of faith that allows people to really sustain their world.
There's one crucifix with, I called it, I don't know what the picture's called, but I called it Robot Christ because it's made out of these little technical pieces of, they look like metal parts of some kind.
Yeah, that was a Tony Price sculptor. Sculpture,
and okay.
You know, Tony Price was just a marvelous artist, and he would create these great sculptures out of sort of the castaway stuff from Los Alamos.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, and so that was like one of the great pieces that he did. Unfortunately, he passed away because he was one of our real treasures.
We're talking to Jack Parsons about his new book, Dark Beauty. It's a book of photographs of New Mexico. Now, you dedicated the book to your grandmother, Elsie Clues Parsons. Tell us about her.
She was an anthropologist who came. She was brought up in New York and Washington and Massachusetts, and she came to the West as an anthropologist in the 30s. She studied with Franz Boas in Columbia. And she came out here early on and did a lot of work with the Pueblo Indians and some with the Zunis, but mostly with the Pueblos. And she's always been a hero or a heroine of mine because she did it on her own. She'd be by herself. She'd ride her horse, go into these places, and she'd live in these villages and really learn about the culture and the religion. And then she published a marvelous two-volume work with the University of Chicago Press on Pueblo Indian religion. And this was a woman of privilege, and she could have just taken her place in society and just become, you know, sort of non-entity.
Or armchair anthropologist.
Or at best, yeah. But she didn't. She really, she decided she was going to be the real thing. And she was one of the first of the women anthropologists, you know, that Boas had championed all along with Margaret Mead and others. And so she was a very tough, interesting, very dedicated scientist. And the most interesting thing to me about her was she was never culture bound. She was not part. even though she was brought up in a certain way in Newport and New York, she never succumbed to that life, and she saw everybody with the same kind of objective, dispassionate eye. And she saw her friends at the Pueblos the same way she would see her friends in New York. That did not necessarily thrill her friends in New York, because she was, as an early feminist, she was advocating things like trial marriage, which they were not, like, thrilled by.
Right. It must be nice to have a feminist grandmother.
It's great to have a feminist grandmother, as my wife will tell you. No, it's certainly, you know, it's a kind of, you know, having somebody like that in your family is like, it's like a time bomb, you know. It just keeps going off, you know. You suddenly say, my God, you know, this is a woman who saw this stuff early on, and, you know, and when you're dealing with these same sort of issues that she must have dealt with, you're saying, you're just filled with nothing but admiration that she could be so sort of far-seeing about this stuff.
And as a photographer, in many ways, one could say that you're walking in her footsteps.
Yeah, indirectly. I would never have the temerity to say that I'm walking in her footsteps, because I think her accomplishments are going to be substantially greater than mine. But I think she's been a huge influence on me. I mean, her sense of adventure, her sense of escaping from a known world and taking chances with her life, and being in the West as opposed to being in the East, all these things, I think, were major influences on me, and you know, for that I'm very thankful and grateful.
Jack Parsons, you've been taking photographs for decades here in New Mexico. How did this particular book come together?
Well, that's kind of a good question, because I'm not sure how it came together, except that I realized that I sort of wanted to wind up my sort of visual life here, and I wanted to sort of have a coda to it after all these years, and I wanted it to be the pictures that I thought were important as opposed to pictures that we all had to do to earn a living. And consequently, you know, I started going through my files very seriously over a period of 2 or 3 years and started putting this stuff together, you know, pulling pictures, discarding pictures. It took a really long time. And that was really the reason for this book, was to sort of, I felt like I'd lived here long enough, I could do a book like this without it being trivial and without sort of carpetbagging the state, essentially. So I wanted to have that sort of finality of a book at my age. I'm 72, and I wanted it to be what I wanted as opposed to what somebody else might have wanted.
And I think, ironically, or maybe not ironically, but the result of that is that it's such a compelling book. It's not something that somebody else commissioned. It's something that comes really from your heart.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is like, I think, the 16th book I've done. And of all of them, this is the one that's most meaningful to me for reasons I've just talked about.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody on this one. I mean, this is all my decision making, you know, it's my success or failure. So,
did the photographs, were they taken over a series of many years?
Yeah, they were. They started in 1970, I think that's the earliest photograph, because I came to New Mexico in 1969, and the last photograph in the book, I think, was taken in 2009. So that's a pretty good span.
When you look at these color photographs, there's always issues with the reproduction. Do you feel that the reproduction in this book is true to the vision that you had in the original photographs?
Yeah, I think it's very, very close. And I was really fortunate working with a very talented, you know, brilliant book designer named David Skulkin. And working with him, and then working with Joanna Hurley, who sort of helped shepherd this whole thing through, really made a huge difference, because we were all on the same page together, and there were no shortcuts being taken, and nobody was under the gun particularly on this. So we could really, really look at everything and make sure that the scans were right. And then David went over to Singapore to make sure, you know, for the print run to make sure that everything would be perfect. So we spent an enormous amount of time looking at every picture, making sure it was exactly right. I did the initial scanning, and then when things had to be rescanned, there's a wonderful outfit here called Fire Dragon, they rescanned. And then David just, he's a brilliant designer, and he just sort of then put it together and gave it a kind of pacing and enough of an interest so that not all of photographs were the same size, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. The book is called Dark Beauty, Photographs of New Mexico by Jack Parsons, with an introduction by Frederick Turner, who is going to be at the book launch. The book launch is happening this Sunday from 2 to 4 at the New Mexico History Museum, and Frederick Turner wrote the introduction, and he will be there, and Carmela Padillo will also be there. How do you envision this event at the museum?
Well, I hope it'll be successful. There's going to be a discussion that's sort of been tentatively titled The Picturesque in Photography. And I guess we'll all sort of talk about that a little bit. And maybe for some of us it'll be just a springboard to talk about other things. But anyway, I think it's going to be very interesting. Fred Turner is a fabulous writer, and so is Carmela. And they, you know, Carmela and I have done a lot of books together, so she has a certain interest in we share a mutual interest in the same subjects. And Fred did, I think, a fabulous job with the introduction, and it's really good. I mean, it talks about memory and loss and picture, and what is the picturesque, and, you know, it's not just a pejorative statement. So I'm fascinated to see what people are going to actually discuss at this book launch.
Jack Parsons, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we will see you on Sunday.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Sandra Shackle. She is a professor of history emerita at Boise State University, and she's the author of several books, the newest one of which is called Working the Land, The Stories of Ranch and Farm Women in the Modern American West. And she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So how did you undertake this study? What is the breadth and scope of it?
Well, the study started as a request to write a chapter for a book of essays that took a look at women's lives in the modern West. And by that, historians generally mean post-World War II, up to the present.
Right.
And so I thought, oh, great idea, because I had done a dissertation at University of New Mexico in the early 90s, and one of the chapters dealt with the Home Extension Service here and rural people. So I had a little bit of background that way. Then when I began to do research for the chapter for this book to be published by University Press of Kansas, I couldn't find anything on modern women, really, that had been written. So because I have spent a lot of my research time as a social historian doing oral interviews, then it seemed like the logical thing to do was go talk to the farm and ranch women.
And so where did you begin?
Well, I didn't begin with any kind of scientific questions or studies. I had come from this Midwestern agricultural area background, although I had not really grown up on a farm. I'd grown up in a small town surrounded by cornfields and soybean fields. My uncle and his wife and two sons were the last farmers in our family. So I visited the farm as a kid, you know, and enjoyed jumping in the hay mow and tromping through the pig pen and all sorts of, you know, things that kids like to do, but never personally lived on it.
Well, and as some of the people in your book point out, it's really a great place for kids to grow up.
Yes, and almost all of the women that I spoke to that are mothers all agreed that it's the best upbringing for children, because it, you know, instills important values, particularly of hard work. You have to milk the cows before you go to school.
And that's one of the things that's interesting about this book is the changing patterns of work for women in the post-war period, which is due to a lot of factors, social changes where women were changing their role purposely, but also economic changes, farm equipment.
Absolutely. In fact, I didn't interview this person, but this was a conversation she had with another oral interviewer, and it was recounted in another book. She was having trouble reaching the pedals on her tractor, and I think she must have had some aches and pains or something, and she went to her doctor, who told her, "Well, you know, tractors aren't made for women to ride." And he said, "No, you shouldn't be riding on a tractor, because that's a man's job." And she realized, well, the tractors were made for men, not women. So she modified her tractor and put blocks on the pedals so that she could reach them without getting a backache.
Simple solution.
Exactly.
Typical of women's minds. But, it's interesting to read this, because one of the hopes of, as you write in the book, or as one of the people says in your book, Working the Land, is that one of the hopes about farm equipment was that it would allow farmers to not have the incredibly hard drudgery of labor and then elevate them to a middle-class status.
Yes, that is part of what was going on after World War II. And ironically, the growth of equipment literally in size and cost came to be a terrible burden for farmers by the 1970s and 80s.
Just because that put them so much into debt.
That's right. In the meantime, women, I want to make clear, as most people probably imagine, women have always worked in the fields. I mean, historically, they always haven't, you know, all around the world. What I discovered was that their stories hadn't been told in great detail, particularly, you know, in the contemporary period. And that's what I was after. I asked them, how has your life changed over the years as you've been on the farm or ranch? How the equipment, the chores, the who raised the children, who did the laundry? I mean, how did all those tasks work out? So I had about a 5-page survey that I ask of all the women that carried right through to the present, including the women's movement, whether they were aware of it, whether it affected their lives at all. And more than one told me that they weren't particularly aware of it, and they didn't think they personally needed it because they were already equal partners with their spouse.
Well, and that's interesting, because some of the women you interviewed really seemed like they had wonderful equal partnerships, but then there are others where the man definitely was dominant, and there was mm-hmm. one where he bought, even though she thought they had an equal partnership, then he started buying equipment without telling her and things like that.
Exactly. She wasn't too happy about that. Right. That's exactly right. There's almost two faces of agriculture. First of all, historically, agriculture is very patriarchal by nature. And part of that has to do with the physical strength that's needed sometimes to manage animals or to plow or
right.
whatever. But even as, since I, this is a book that's focused on the West, 17 Western states, the book doesn't cover all the states, but that's how historians generally consider the West, is region is about 17 states. And women in the wagons or walking across out west, you know, so forth, their husbands couldn't have succeeded in clearing the trees, for example, or building a soddy, you know, without another pair of hands, and of course the children. For so long, agricultural families were large because they needed those laborers. So children were an important part of farming and ranching as well.
To what extent did the children of the women you interviewed, a lot of whom were kind of grandmother age generation.
Many were.
Mm-hmm. To what extent did their children continue on in the business, in the family farm?
Well, as you might expect, closer to World War II, there was more of the sons, particularly going into the farming and agricultural business. But in the last generation or two, that's been less so. And a lot of reasons for that. One is the growth of technology in this country has provided many more attractive jobs, less physical labor for people. And so many of their children didn't want to stay on the farm or return to the farm. On the other hand, maybe one out of several would do so. I found that several times. The children appreciated growing up. The women told me this, that they had told their parents they really were glad they were raised on a farm or in a small rural area, but they just couldn't see their future there. And statistics bear that out, because today we're a nation in which less than 2% are listed on census as farm operators, farm or ranch operators.
And, of course, the small family farm is under tremendous economic competition from agribusiness, which produces food cheaply, although it may not be sustainable or healthy or anything else.
I know. That is greatly debated, of course. The push for agribusiness, of course, again, post-World War II and prosperity and so forth, but by the 70s and 80s, big companies were buying out a lot of family farms, and that has continued. I mean, the number of small family farms has continued to decline. But the most recent agricultural census, which is done every 5 years, kind of at an off time, for example, 2002 and then 2007, whereas we have 2000, 2010, but the agricultural census are done differently. And some interesting things came out of this last one in 2007, and that is that it was the middle group that has declined the most, the middle-sized American farm, and there are several gradations, I guess, that determine how your farm is judged, from the amount of animals you have or crops you produce or amount of money or amount of land and so forth. So agribusiness continues to be big. Small farms, you know, 400 acres or less, simply continue to persist. And I'm not sure entirely why, except that in this last decade, I would say, we've had a renewed interest in local foods. So the local food movement
right.
is playing a role.
Farmers markets, farm to table. Mm-hmm. Well, but also, as you say, there are farmers who are making ends meet through other means,
yes.
through allowing hunting on their land, through doing wage labor off of the farm.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I think farming has never faded away entirely. Because, again, even before World War II, many women worked off farm. They might be teachers. They might have been clerks in the local rural town, whatever. And this accelerated, you know, as 60s, 70s, and 80s, as the economy became harder for everybody. I mean, urban families, the wife was suddenly going to work because they needed two paychecks. This had been going on already in the farms, as you might imagine, all this time.
Right.
And sometimes the husband or farmer would work off farm and be a teacher himself, and the woman would run the farm during the week, and he'd come home on the weekends, and there might be children involved that were helping her too.
Now, one of the things that is also not surprising was that a lot of women were doing more and more work outside the mm-hmm. house. In other words, they were working in the fields, they were working with animals, they were operating tractors and so on. But that there was not a corresponding increase of men doing dishes or laundry.
That's right. I don't know if that has changed at all in urban families, but...
Oh, it has, definitely, in urban families.
It seemed like my students, you know, they pitch in and do much more than probably their fathers and certainly their grandfathers ever did.
Yeah.
But on the farms, it's still... those inside the house and outside the house were two terms that were used very often. I've interviewed over 50 women in about 15 years since I started this project. And despite the stereotypes of the inside farm wife, many wives work outside and love it. One of the reasons, besides raising children on a farm or ranch, is that they love being outdoors. They love the natural experience with dirt, with soil, with the climate, you know, and the surroundings.
And if they didn't, they probably wouldn't have chosen to be farm wives.
Right, and some didn't. You know, they married into it. Or they fought it at first, or some continue to stay in teaching elementary school, you know. The little bit larger, a little bit more successful family farms could afford to hire some help. Hired help is what my uncle used to call it, the hired hands. That's what he called them. He had some
right.
people working for him.
Of which there are probably fewer now, as that's not an economically viable way of life.
Yeah, right. Pay would be extremely low.
Yeah.
Which is another reason why smaller farms, maybe they aren't so economically self-sustaining, right? Yeah. But nevertheless, somebody else is bringing in an income from somewhere else, you know, and they then are able to still stay on the family farm.
We're talking to Sandra Shackle about her book, Working the Land, The Stories of Ranch and Farm Women in the Modern American West. So was it, I mean, you interviewed farmers and ranchers, and was there any difference between those two groups, people who worked more with plants and more with animals?
Well, there's a clear difference. With farms, most often you might have animals, but you'd probably have row crops too, wheat or hay or beans or mint or whatever, peanuts. Ranchers, that generally conjures up more land, larger land, and the larger animals, particularly horses and cows, for a herd. You might have horses to work the cattle, but the cattle would be the major source of the ranch's income. A lot of women love to be on horseback and love the ranching life. I interviewed many of them that preferred that, but they have been able to adapt, I would say, 20th and 21st century technology themselves into the tasks they do. If they go out on a roundup or go out every day and repair fence or whatever, they've got something in the crock pot or something in the freezer, or they might keep the family records, but it's online now. So in many ways, their lives changed drastically from their grandmothers. When I first started this project, I knew I would be interviewing some older women because I wanted to see those changes right after the war in the 50s and 60s, but I didn't want to limit it to that group. So my youngest interviewee was 24 when I interviewed her, and I think that was 2002, and she was a young Colorado woman working with horses and cattle. She and her husband also have a cattle ranch, or a family cattle ranch, her brother and her dad. And then there's a middle group of women who are married to ranchers or farmers. And you mentioned the term ranch or farm. When I ask a woman to self-identify herself, I said, what do you call yourself? You know, I let them speak, and sometimes I got, I'm just a housewife. I'm just a farm wife. I work, you know, I took care of the children and cooked and cleaned and that sort of thing. Others would say, I'm a farmer. I'm a rancher. I'm a gopher, you know, go to town for parts and
right.
Whatever. And interesting thing about modern wives is they rarely cook lunch for hired hands anymore because there's fewer of them. But if they do have half a dozen, say, during haying season, they'll go to McDonald's and bring back, you know, fast food for them.
Oh, my goodness.
So not always the big chuck wagon meals,
right.
Although roundups, I've encountered some roundups where that still goes on because you do have a big group of people to feed for a couple days you're branding.
And as you point out in the book, it's a life that makes people strong, resilient, flexible, and very resourceful.
Yes, they are resourceful. When you mentioned, when you asked me about work off the farm, some of them bring in extra income with what's now called agricultural tourism. And it's not unique to America. It's quite popular in Europe, too.
What's that?
Well, in Europe, it's you could rent a farmhouse. You know, you can be touring and you can stay overnight in a farmhouse and a farm meal, you know, be cooked for you and so forth. In America, I think there might be some of that. But I interviewed two women who had bed and breakfast operations. And interestingly, Peggy Monzingo in near Benson, Arizona, she doesn't now, she's pretty elderly now, but she had a bed and breakfast operation. But she used it to for her political activism around agriculture, about the issue between environmentalists and ranchers. And she told me, she said, I almost don't feed them until they sit and listen to me talk about the the issues
what
you know,
was
on
her
the
position?
Ranch. Well, she was very anti-environmentalist because she said, who can better take care of their land and their animals than the people who are ranching and farming? And yet we hear, quote, the environmentalists, they often get lumped together in a group as people who think no cows should be grazing on this land. So, you know, I had to sound people out on that. And I didn't take a position, but I learned a lot. There's ground on both sides to be, you know, honored, I think. So bed and breakfast, the hunting. Gretchen Samus up here in northern New Mexico near Cimarron has a historic ranch, the Manly Chase Ranch. He was her great-great-grandfather, and she's inherited that 10,000 acres. And they've been, she and her manager partner Ruby Goebel have been opening the land for hunts for many years.
Sandra Shackle is a professor emerita at Boise State University, and she's the author of several books, including the latest, which is Working the Land, the Stories of Ranch and Farm Women in the Modern American West. It's published by the University Press of Kansas. And she will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Lo Effecto. She is the director of New Mexico Arts, which is a division of the State Department of Cultural Affairs, and she's here to tell us about the Governor's Awards, the Governor's Arts Awards. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte, and thank you for helping us to promote our exciting event coming up this Friday, September 16th. This will be the 38th Governor's Arts Awards. It was an event started first by Bruce King and his wife Alice back in the day, and we're very glad to have Governor Susana Martinez on board this year.
And so you, basically, the department gives awards to a handful of artists and sometimes arts organizations and patrons of the arts, and just basically honors them and brings their work and their activities to the public.
That's correct. In New Mexico, the Governor's Arts Awards are generally a lifetime achievement award, and we've had some very outstanding awardees over the years, including Tony Hillerman, Maria Martinez, Tammy Garcia, Georgia O'Keeffe, and last year, Robert Redford. And we're also very excited about this year's 7 awardees.
Let's talk about them for a moment.
We have Judy Chicago of Berlin for Multidisciplinary Arts, and Judy is known throughout the world as a wonderful feminist artist. Her dinner party is permanently installed in the Brooklyn Museum in New York. But what people might not know is Judy also has done, with her husband Donald Woodman, a photographer, an amazing amount of work here in New Mexico. They're based in Berlin. They've helped to revitalize that town, an important city in New Mexico. Judy has a nonprofit through The Flower that operates out of there, and she's created a women's cultural corridor from Taos to Berlin.
A women's cultural corridor, what's that?
It celebrates women artists from Georgia O'Keeffe and Abiquiu, artists up in Taos, herself in Berlin, and then traveling through Santa Fe and also Albuquerque.
And so people can visit the places where that work can be seen?
Exactly. They've created kind of a mini arts trails, which is something we've done at New Mexico Arts as well.
Now, you have also Arnold Herrera from Coche de Pueblo, traditional Pueblo arts.
Exactly. And Arnold is known for, he's a famous drum maker. He's also a wonderful educator, cultural interpreter, and preservationist. He's also celebrated for his silverwork jewelry and red willow baskets. But the drum work he's done, it's just amazing. And he loves to educate people. And one of his nominators had said of Arnold, by interacting with his art, we become artists ourselves, which I think is a really nice way.
That's quite an amazing thing to say. So let's see, who else? Robert Highsmith.
He's a watercolorist from Las Cruces. He does New Mexico landscapes, very dramatic and beautiful. And he, too, embodies, I think, the best of New Mexico in portraying his art. He's a signature member of the New Mexico Watercolor Society and the American Watercolor Society.
Now, Amadeus Leitner is the person, is the artist whose image is on your poster, and that is an incredibly beautiful poster of a butte against a kind of desert landscape.
It's a shiprock, and it's a very famous, often photographed image, but I think you'll see that Amadeus has a way of interpreting art in our landscape in New Mexico in a really unique way. He's one of our younger recipients ever. He's a Chimayo native now living in Santa Fe, and his photography is just really top-notch and inspirational.
It's exquisite. Of course it's Shiprock. I looked at it and didn't even see that. It's fabulous. Can people actually get a commemorative poster?
Yeah, these posters are going to be around town and available.
A couple of other artists. Bill Wiggins is another painter, and then Bruce and Marianne Larson are contributors to the arts.
Bill Wiggins is 93 years old, and he has sort of started painting in the 1940s, working on oil, and never stopped. His is a real inspiring story. He suffered from macular degeneration in recent years, but he's refused to let his dwindling eyesight slow him down, and in fact, he's created a new series working in watercolor this time, called the Macular Degeneration Series.
Oh my goodness!
And he's it's a really cool story.
When you look at it, can you tell that he's losing his eyesight?
No, you can't. And it's just, but he sort of transcends in that way. And I think that's one of the really exciting things about art, is it really does tell the story of New Mexico.
Yeah.
But it also, it's so very transformational and inspirational. And Bruce and Marianne Larson, they live here in Santa Fe. They're major contributors to the arts, receiving an award this year. And they've done amazing things, both for our New Mexico museums. Bruce was instrumental in creating an endowment for our new New Mexico History Museum. Marianne played a central role to bring what was then the Aspen Ballet also to Santa Fe in its current configuration in the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. And they do a lot on behalf of the Lensic, the Santa Fe International Folk Art Market, and Futures for Children. And they're not only donors, they're doers, it's been said of them. And they're both very wonderful people.
And finally, the Las Cruces International Mariachi Conference.
This is also out of Las Cruces, and they host some 13,000 youth since they began in 1994, and they've reached more than 150,000 audience members. So it's a wonderful tourist draw here to New Mexico, as well as working with kids, keeping a really unique New Mexico art form, the mariachi, alive and well. And we're very excited about having them be recipients this year as well.
So the Governor's Arts Awards ceremonies are coming up on this Friday, and at 5:15, from 5:15 to 7, there is... Now, let's see.
Yeah, that's the award ceremony. And
there's a reception, though, before that.
At 3:30.
Okay, thank you.
And both of these are free and open to the public. We invite everybody to please come out on Friday, September 16th. At 3:30, there's an opening of the governor, an exhibit honoring the governor's awardees. You'll be able to see their work and also learn more about them. It's in the governor's gallery right outside the governor's office on the fourth floor of the state capitol. That's at 3:30. And then at 5:15, the actual award ceremony is at St. Francis Auditorium in the New Mexico Museum of Art.
And that's a wonderful space.
It is.
And the artists will all be there. And
it's usually a wonderful, touching event. One of my favorite moments happened several years ago when Nancy Youngblood was a recipient. And, you know, her grandmother, Maria Martinez, had also received an award. And Nancy was talking about how she's received awards all over the world, but she remembered being a young child when her grandmother received the award. And the award she wanted most was the Governor's Arts Award.
Loie Fecteau is the director of New Mexico Arts. That's a division of the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. And for more information, is there a website?
There's information up on our website at www.nmarts.org, and you'll see a section on the Governor's Arts Awards.
Loie, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.